is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Democrats are divided. And really, that's nothing new. They were divided when Bernie Sanders took on Hillary Clinton in 2016. They were divided when Barack Obama took on Hillary Clinton in 2008. But this year is different. The party has moved left. Progressives and young people, many voters of color, see a chance to fundamentally change their party and change politics. But older Democrats, maybe they're not as open to change. They're definitely not as online, and they definitely vote. And underneath it all, the fights over health care or college tuition or policing is an even more important question. Who will beat Donald Trump?
This is no time to take a risk. We need our strongest candidate. So let's nominate the Democrat Trump fears the most. Vote Biden. Beat Trump.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
Suddenly, we have the Democratic establishment very nervous about this campaign. We got Wall Street nervous. We got the insurance companies nervous. We got the drug companies nervous. We got the fossil fuel industry nervous. We are their worst nightmare.
There you have it. Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, just two representatives of the divided Dems. Should they play it safe and make politics normal again? Or go big, go left, and try to excite progressives? Well, we'll get to the heart of the Democratic dilemma. But first, let's get a view on the ground from New Hampshire, where people are gearing up for tomorrow's first in the nation primary. Joining me now from Concord is Dan Barrick. He's the news director for the great New Hampshire Public Radio. Dan, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad that people turn to NHPR at this time of year every 4 years. It's very necessary. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, happy to.
Dan, we're a day away from the New Hampshire primary. What's the state of the race?
It is, as you said, divided, busy, very active. There's kind of a blend on the ground of, you know, traditionally this period, the real eve of the primary is kind of a celebratory time for folks who love politics in New Hampshire, which is a lot of folks in New Hampshire. But there is also this layer of really earnest approach by voters who are showing up in really large numbers over the last few days to candidate events, and a real deep anxiety on their part as well about the unsettled nature of the field, about the direction the party needed to take on Trump. You're hearing a lot of this. You know, we had reporters out across the state at candidate events over the past week, and what they're coming back with as they talk to voters is a real sense of uncertainty, both the fact that Iowa didn't really end up with a firm direction to kind of hand off to New Hampshire, and the fact that these divisions, as you laid out within the party, are still very much at the forefront. We're seeing it both at candidate events, talking with voters, at big party events that were happening over the weekend, a big New Hampshire Democratic Party fundraiser at which there was booing between camps as different candidates were speaking. There's still just a lot of uncertainty and unsettled nature.
Yeah,
right now.
Dan, how are voters expressing that anxiety? We saw, you know, before Iowa kind of fell apart, a lot of undecideds, a lot of people walking into the caucus room not knowing what to do simply because the thing on their mind was who can beat Trump. I'll put it all aside if you can tell me who will beat Trump. How do people in New Hampshire express that?
You're hearing that same thing, and you're hearing it in part from folks sort of congratulating themselves maybe for only narrowing it down. They've got it down to three candidates now that they're trying to decide from. That's an advance. That's progress in their mind. You're seeing it, as I said, just in the size of the events. I mean, you know, the campaign has really been going on here for more than a year in New Hampshire in terms of the level of candidate activity and the media attention. But for many voters, you know, they really, despite New Hampshire's reputation as this deeply engaged state, which many voters are, a lot of voters do just kind of wait to check in until the last few days. And as I said, traditionally for some of them, the results out of the Iowa caucuses might provide kind of a flashlight to help them get to their vote. But just the size and the turnout that we're seeing, and also the fact that the candidates are really engaging with each other across, you know, kind of this bigger vision, this bigger idea around the vision of the party. Voters are really trying to navigate that, but all towards that single end of electability, which is not only who's the right candidate, but what's the right vision for the party that we're going to need to take to November to defeat Trump.
Part of the concern this year, and maybe it's just a concern among outsiders, I don't know, will New Hampshire go smoothly? Because Iowa didn't. Give us a sense of how New Hampshire works and whether there are additional safeguards, additional checks going up. Look, New Hampshire does this every 4 years and they do it well, but are people a little nervous or spooked because of what happened in Iowa?
Well, state officials here are definitely trying to answer that concern and resolve it. Just last week, there was a pretty strong show of force, a public press conference, rather unusual, by the governor of the state, the attorney general, and the secretary of state who administers elections, who basically had a very simple message, which is like, we're not Iowa. We've got this in the bag. We know how to do this. And there are pretty significant differences between the two states, between the New Hampshire primary and the Iowa caucuses. The first is that the caucus is an event that's actually, you know, it's a party-run event in Iowa, whereas the primary is run by local poll workers, by thousands of poll workers in cities and towns who are trained to administer these elections. New Hampshire has a paper ballot system, so that a lot of election officials like to point to the fact that there is a paper trail in the event of any kind of confusion or conflict. The state will be clear to lay out kind of what their process will be like on primary day tomorrow. That includes having folks from the Attorney General's office at every polling place in New Hampshire. Some of this is par for the course, but you can tell they're really trying to send a message out that there is going to be extra scrutiny, extra attention, that they're very concerned about not coming out of the primary with any kind of confusion or lack of resolution, just about the process, about the administration of the election.
So, Dan Barrick, what is it like to be a New Hampshire resident after the primary? All the candidates and the media pick up their tents. They move on to the next show. You know, on the one hand, it makes me think it must be like that feeling when you're sitting on your couch with a glass of wine and all the party guests have left and it's just you in silence with your cat. Except in New Hampshire, everybody has a lot of money to count during that time. So what's it like?
It gets lonely. But, you know, this is sort of part of the ritual. You know, New Hampshire has had this lock on the first in the nation status and has gotten really good both at, you know, putting on the primary, putting on the show. There is a whole sub-economy, as you alluded to, there's a sub-economy of the primary, the event planners and hotels and, you know, consultants who know how to make a living or at least pad their living with the primary, and that goes away. But the rituals of the primary, the kind of ebbs and flows of the campaign are pretty well known to folks here. But yeah, without a doubt, you know, you walk down Elm Street in Manchester to the heart of the state's biggest city the morning after the primary, and you'll just see a lot of empty, almost abandoned-looking offices with discarded campaign signs and literature and sort of bedraggled-looking campaign aides, unsure what assignment, what state they'll be sent to next. So we're looking for that on Wednesday.
A lot more parking spaces because all the live trucks are gone on the main street, right? Just more space than there used to be. So it certainly feels like an empty nest, maybe. Is it empty nest?
Yeah, it's empty nest. I like to sort of like senior spring kind of feel where you kind of, you know, have the last big party and then everybody goes their way and you know, that's just kind of how it goes.
Well, Dan, we're going to go. Let me read you one quick message from Conrad, who said, I was knocking on doors in Iowa for a candidate last weekend. One after the other told me they could not decide who to caucus for, but that they will vote for whoever wins to beat Trump in November. Democrats will rally around the candidate in the end. Do you get a sense like that in New Hampshire?
Definitely. I mean, when people talk in the abstract, certainly. I think the fervor to take on Trump among Democrats here is very strong. But as I said, too, you know, there are, you know, this happens in primaries, of course. You know, candidates start attacking each other and their supporters start attacking each other. We have definitely seen that, you know, between Bernie and Biden and Buttigieg. We'll see just kind of how that resolves itself as this campaign goes on to other states after New Hampshire.
Oh, that's Dan Barrick, news director of New Hampshire Public Radio. Dan, thanks for making the time. I appreciate it.
Sure, happy to.
By the way, be sure to check out New Hampshire Public Radio's podcast about the New Hampshire primary. It's called Stranglehold. And coming up, we'll zoom out and talk about this split among the Democrats over how to beat Donald Trump. Stay close. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Why is it so hard to make new habits? Are pets really that great for us? Why can't I remember where I put my keys? Would you rather be given an award or a bonus? Answers to these questions and more every week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Joining me now from NHPR in Concord, New Hampshire, is Dan Neuhauser, senior political reporter for Vice News. Dan, welcome back to 1A.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
Great. Thanks for being here. Also with us, two Democratic strategists. Yvette Simpson is the CEO of Democracy for America. They're a progressive political action committee. She joins us from Cincinnati Public Radio. Yvette, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Great to have you. And here with me in the studio is Maria Cardona. She's the principal of Dewey Square Group. They're a public affairs firm. She was a senior advisor to the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign in 2008, part of their Hispanic outreach team. Maria, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Dan Neuhauser, you're there in Concord. Set the table for us. What's the state of the race?
I got to be honest, it's getting just a little bit ugly here. I was driving around the state last night and went to a Pete Buttigieg event where he was sort of lightly attacking Bernie Sanders. Sanders, of course, has also been, trying to make the case that Buttigieg is not progressive enough to be the nominee. And of course, Biden, having seen a pretty disappointing result in Iowa, is lashing out also at Buttigieg. So we're kind of seeing. I hate to use the old term, but a circular firing squad here. And it's got to give Democrats anxiety that this fight between progressives and moderates or the new generation and the old generation is just going to damage any candidate going into the general.
Dan, is it okay this early in the race to have that and it'll get better when candidates winnow out, or is it a harbinger of bad things to come?
It's too early to say. I mean, we saw in 2016, of course, how ugly that got, and the ugliness of that is still pervading into the election this year. Certainly on the Bernie Sanders side, there's this interesting meme going around. Bernie Sanders supporters take a picture of themselves looking sort of like a hippie with a peace sign and flowers, and that's voting before the Iowa caucus. The next picture is them dressed like Rambo voting after the Iowa caucus, right? They are ready to go. And unfortunately, just the mess that Iowa has become is just not good for trust in institutions, trust in the system. There's a lot of conspiratorial thinking abounding, and that is, I think, that is going to stay with the candidates throughout this election cycle, and that might end up being the most damaging aspect of all of this.
All right, that's the state of the race. Dan Neuhauser says it's getting ugly in a lot of ways, both between the candidates and in terms of process. Maria, you worked for Hillary Clinton in 2008, as I mentioned, thought of as the establishment wing of the party. I think that's fair.
Mm-hmm. I'm also, you should know, part of the, I'm a DNC member and on the Rules and Bylaws Committee.
Ah, okay, so you're right there on the DNC. So let's talk about what's behind this anxiety. Mm-hmm. Let's get into it. What's the best establishment or moderate Dem pitch for why Biden or Buttigieg or Bloomberg, if you like, even Klobuchar, moderate, traditional, more moderate,
sure,
establishment is best positioned to beat Donald Trump? What's the best case?
Well, what you will hear from folks is that the Democratic Party needs a nominee that will not only mobilize and energize the base of the party, but that will also be able to attract independent and disaffected Republicans. And the narrative out there is that somebody like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren are too progressive for the likes of independents, for the likes of moderate, middle-of-the-road, centrist Democrats, frankly, because the fear is, and what I have heard from many people, is that if somebody like Bernie Sanders gets elected, the only thing that Donald Trump needs to do is to say socialist.
Over and
to
over.
Say it over and over and over again. And so that is, and the other part of the pitch is that the solutions that Americans want are actually solutions that will be able to be passed. We know very well that, for example, a Medicare for all with a divided Congress, for example, if we take over the Senate, that's great. But even so, Medicare for all might not be something that the majority of the country wants or is ready for.
All right, Yvette, you work for progressives, progressive super PACs, and progressive causes. What's your best pitch for why Senator Sanders or Senator Warren, why one of them would stand the best chance of beating Donald Trump?
I would say in an election like this one, you really need to fire up your base. You really need to expand your electorate, getting brown and black voters, getting young millennial voters to show up. And unfortunately, for so long, the Democratic model was let's get someone right in the middle and black people, poor people, non-regular voters will show up. And what we know is that that hasn't happened. You need a candidate that can inspire. What Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have done have finally spoken to the part of the party that we don't talk to. And guess what? They're showing up and they're showing out. So that's what the moderate wing of the party is worried about. If Democrats actually vote with their values and Bernie Sanders is a nominee, how do we win? Well, that's what we're supposed to be. We're Democrats. We're supposed to actually support the candidate that our people pick. And if Bernie Sanders is that person, if Elizabeth Warren is that person, then we should support that person. You know, for a long, long time, the moderates have neglected the values of the left flank of the party. And what's happening now is I think they feel like they're under threat because now those voices are being heard. Let's be clear about some of these issues, though. Medicare for All, Green New Deal, these progressive issues poll very, very well across our party and among Republicans. So we can't continue to say that these are threatening things that we can't win with. Bernie Sanders also gets a lot of support from independents. That was something that people criticized him for in the moderate wing of the party, that he had too many quote unquote Trump supporters that were supporting him. Joe Rogan endorses him. That's insane. So the idea that Bernie Sanders can't unify our country is ridiculous. What people want right now is someone who they can believe,
right,
who is consistent, who has values and sticks by them. And I think that's a winning strategy. And Elizabeth Warren has a similar, strategy.
Now, we got this message from Oliver who said, as an independent voter who's disgusted with Trump, I have hopes for the Democrats, but they are as split and disunited as candidates are in this country overall. They can't seem to see their two main problems, that they have two left-wing people who will get blown off the debate stage by Trump, and that their moderates can't beat him in debates either. And Kylie tweeted this: the truth is there is not one candidate who could unite the Democratic Party at this time. So if the DNC will nominate the most popular candidate and not make the same mistake in 2020 that they made in 2016, Bernie Sanders absolutely could be the nominee. Well, we asked you if Senator Bernie Sanders could be the Democratic nominee or if he should be. A lot of you said yes. This, of course, isn't the only view out there, but here's a representation of what many of you left us using our app, 1A Vox Pop.
I supported Bernie Sanders back in 2016, and I am fully supporting him now in 2020.
Of course, Bernie is the only one who can beat Trump.
Bernie Sanders should definitely be the Democratic nominee. He's the only one that Trump is really fearing.
He inspires a lot of young people. I think a lot of older people that are moderate would also vote for him, especially in this election cycle, you know, to get rid of Donald Trump, because anybody's better than Donald Trump.
Bernie Sanders attracts a more fervent and more excited group of people than any other candidate on that stage. And that, honestly, is what we need in a candidate.
Liberty emailed, I'm an older Democratic voter who's always been more liberal than the candidates we've just been stuck with. The party should not be hobbling the effort to bring bold ideas into the process. Dan Neuhauser, is Bernie Sanders a special case in terms of his appeal maybe to non-voters, his ability to expand the number of people who come to the polls?
There's no doubt about that. When I go to Bernie Sanders events, it doesn't take long to see that this is a different kind of voter. Generally, a much younger crowd, more people of color, not so much in Iowa and New Hampshire because the demographics don't lean that way. But I've seen him out in California and other states. He is absolutely running up the tab among Latino voters. He has some work to do with older voters in general and older African-American voters. But among younger African-American voters, he's doing extremely well. So he certainly has that case to make. Buttigieg, on the other hand, also has a lot of excitement from newer, younger voters. You kind of get the sense that while no candidate is perfect for everybody, you know, if you kind of balled them up into one super candidate, you could have somebody that could win. Maybe at the end of all this process, they will be able to get together and work on each other's behalf.
Now, Yvette Simpson, I asked you for your best pitch for Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, the progressive wing of the party. All candidates have downsides. What's the biggest risk with Senator Sanders or Senator Warren?
I think the biggest risk is that the party doesn't unite behind him. I mean, I think this conversation around socialism is really harmful. And the fact that it's coming from Democrats makes it even more so. He is a Democratic socialist. That Democratic part is the most important part. He's been in the Senate for a long, long time and has mostly supported Democratic values and actually has pulled the Democratic Party, I think, closer to where it needs to be in serving working class people. So I think the biggest risk to a Warren or a Sanders is that the party does not unify behind them and that they're setting up this label to support him. I think people were really concerned about the way that Bernie Sanders speaks, the way that he emotes. People were concerned about Warren and whether or not she will remain consistent, whether she will be tough enough. These are all constructs. Again, these are all things that are based in racism. They're based in, you know, sexism. They're based in what, you know, we traditionally see is valued or valuable. And I think we need to turn from that if we're going to win in November.
Let me turn to Maria. Maria, you made the case for the establishment moderate wing of the party. What's the biggest risk with a Biden or a Buttigieg or a Bloomberg?
I think the biggest risk that we have talked about here is that they won't be able to mobilize and energize the younger voters, is that the younger voters will do what many of them did in 2016 because they didn't get the candidate of their choice. They just picked up their ball and went home and did not vote. So let me just say this. If Bernie Sanders is our nominee, I will be first in line and fighting like hell to make sure that he is elected, because Donald Trump, we have to keep our eye on the ball, right? Donald Trump is the most dangerous president we have had in history. And anybody, I will vote for this coffee cup to make sure.
We agree on that.
I knew we would. So that hopefully will be the unifying thread throughout the party at the end of the day.
Now, Dan, what about your diagnosis here? Look, Donald Trump is extremely unpopular with college women. He's unpopular in many suburbs. And there's a pitch to say, you can vote Democrat if you don't like Donald Trump. But doesn't Bernie Sanders make that very hard for many of those people to say, yes, I'll do something I've never done before, I'll vote for a Democrat?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a block of voters who are put off by the mantle of socialism and for whom it's going to be very difficult to convince them to vote for that. There's also a bunch of Bernie Sanders supporters who, you know, wouldn't probably feel comfortable voting for somebody who's pretty moderate. But there's also a large group of voters in the middle who I've been talking to as I've been traveling around the country that are, I guess I call them like ABT voters, anyone but Trump. You got to remember, Donald Trump is historically unpopular. He won, you know, on the strength of, you know, some tens of thousands of votes in a few key states. And Democrats might be wringing their hands to such a degree over something that is actually a very winnable election.
Well, we got this email from Judy who says, don't ignore Michael Bloomberg. He has the experience, the gravitas, and the track record. He's made a huge difference on issues like gun control and climate change, did a great job managing New York City. We're not going to ignore Michael Bloomberg because we're going to take a pause. We're going to talk about the Bloomberg effect. We're going to talk about the money and what it means in this race. Dan Neuhauser of Vice News, Yvette Simpson of Democracy for America, Maria Cardona of the Dewey Square Group, formerly of the Hillary Clinton campaign. More from our guests and from you in just a moment. It's 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor LegalZoom. LegalZoom can help make sure your small business is set up for success this year. LegalZoom has helped more than 2 million Americans incorporate, form an LLC, and more. You can also get advice on contracts, lease agreements, and other legal questions through LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys, since they're not a law firm. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle so you can share what you know. On the News Roundup, find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
I listen to Bullseye because Jesse always has really good questions.
What did John Malkovich wear when he was 20?
I don't know how to describe it.
Bullseye, interviews with creators you love and creators you need to know. From MaximumFun.org and NPR.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about the Democratic Party strategy to beat Donald Trump in November. Lisa wrote this on our Facebook page. As a New Hampshire resident, I have been involved in more honest, informed conversations this time than in any prior primary. That's what she says. People are talking to each other. There are real discussions about what we agree on, what we disagree on, what's important to us. There is more unity than division, and we need to talk about that. That's from Lisa, who wrote on Facebook. Well, Lisa, I need you to listen to this, because last week, Hillary Clinton was on the Ellen DeGeneres show, and she shared her take on the 2020 race. She didn't name any names, but she had this to say on the subject of electability and trust.
You know, you've got to be responsible for what you say and what you say you're going to do. We need to rebuild trust in our fellow Americans and in our institutions. And if you promise the moon and you can't deliver the moon, then that's going to be one more indicator of how, you know, we just can't trust each other. So it's not good theater. It's not maybe good politics anymore. But I think you should tell people what you mean what you say, and have some sense of responsibility for how you would get anything done that you talk about.
Yvette, Hillary Clinton was widely interpreted there as taking yet another swing at her old nemesis, Bernie Sanders. Look, all parties in all elections have conflicts between factions. That's normal. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton faced off in 2016 in an insurgent progressive force versus the establishment moment. It seems like we're still caught in a moment with Democrats that's fundamentally different somehow.
You know, I've had a couple conversations about my feelings about the way that Hillary Rodham Clinton has handled this election. And I think she is a distraction. And I think she should remember that it was ultimately Donald Trump that stole that election from her. And it should be her number one goal to make sure that he does not remain the president. I think bigger picture, we cannot be a party that talks about what we can't do. The reality is people have been waiting for the world to change for a long time. And they believe that the time is now for that change. They've watched Donald Trump get in and deliver for 1%. And they're saying, why can't Democrats deliver for the 99? And so Hillary going around saying what we can't do isn't helping inspire people to believe in the government. We need them to be inspired so that they can show up. And so what I would implore us all to do is to remember that our unified opponent is Donald Trump. And if you're not helping us, you're hurting us.
Now, Dan Neuhauser, let's talk about some of the hardcore dynamics of this race. We're not writing anyone's epitaph here, but who's looking to be best positioned to scoop up Biden supporters? Who's a second choice if Biden starts to fall by the wayside?
Well, before the debate, I would have said unequivocally Pete Buttigieg, and you needed to look no further than the digital ad that Joe Biden was running very heavily, handedly attacking Buttigieg, to see that that's the case, that that was his bigger threat. Then Amy Klobuchar had a very widely regarded good debate performance. And so really, when you look at sort of the moderate bunch of the party, that the support for each individual candidate is kind of flattening out, kind of capped. It could be that nobody gets no individual moderate, quote unquote, moderate candidate gets a higher support than what is Bernie Sanders' floor of support, which he's shown here, at least in New Hampshire, to be something like 20%.
Yvette, a lot of people say, this may be conventional wisdom, that Elizabeth Warren is best positioned, that she sort of embodies progressivism, but also practicality that many older Dems might think that Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg lack. What do you make of that idea? Is it possible that Elizabeth Warren is the second choice candidate who scoops up a lot of support if Biden falters?
I think so. I mean, I think Amy Klobuchar certainly had a great night. I acknowledge that on debate night. But where does she go from here? Like, does she have a real base of support with the rest of the party? Elizabeth Warren has been building for a long, long time, and she is trusted. I was at the New Hampshire 100 Club dinner, and every time Elizabeth Warren spoke, I saw the entire room clap and stand up. She actually does seem like a candidate that a lot of these other camps seem to be able to get behind. mind. I think part of that is because that question that Hillary Clinton posed around, you need to be able to show that you can do what you can do. She's been able to do a lot of things that people didn't believe that she could do. And she actually has a what she would call a plan for that. And so I think she does have an ability to scoop up some of that.
Ann says this via email. I'm a swing state Pennsylvanian, deep blue and deep green. We are a state deeply divided along an urban-rural split. We're also completely gerrymandered with Republican control. That's changed a bit since a court ruling there. As you know, PA went to Trump by only the slimmest of margins. We need some of the disaffected Republicans to have a Democrat that they can get behind.
I think that that is one of the biggest arguments for moderate candidates that they are making for somebody like Joe Biden and even Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar. I think they've even said that before. One of the biggest realities that we have to remember here is that in the 2018 midterms, we got a lot of the suburban Republican-leaning women who were just so sick of the chaos and of the lack of character of this president, right? The kids in cages, the splitting up of families, all of that was just made the whole country disgusted, including a lot of people who do call themselves Republicans. I think that's a big reason why, you know, even those Republicans are saying that they would be able to vote for a Joe Biden, for example, if the Democrats nominated somebody like that. But I think at the end of the day, you know, what Democrats need to keep their eye on the ball is whoever ends up being our nominee, that is who we have to rally behind. And we do not have the luxury of having either hurt feelings or hurt pride because our candidate did not make it to the mountaintop. The mountaintop is the White House, and it is up to us whether we carry that nominee to the mountaintop or not. And if we don't, if we choose to stay home because our feelings are hurt or our pride is hurt, then we deserve to have Donald Trump reelected.
Now, we have to make sure before this hour ends that we talk in a serious way about Michael Bloomberg. Dan Neuhauser, we won't really see Michael Bloomberg collect any votes until Super Tuesday in March because he's not in Iowa, not New Hampshire, not in any of these early states. But the money, the ads, the endorsements, where does Bloomberg and his money factor fit into this overarching Democratic anxiety we've been talking about?
Well, we're going to see that very soon. Super Tuesday is March 3rd. He wants to run a Super Tuesday strategy, see if he can run up the score by just blitzing the airwaves. I mean, he spent approaching $200 million. Maybe it's more than $200 million as of today, just on ads and organization and staff in states where no other candidate is playing yet because they just don't have the money. It's working. You're seeing his poll numbers up. And I think, I mean, my sense is that Bloomberg is pitching himself as the moderate alternative if Biden collapses, being that Buttigieg is young. He's only 38, after all. He doesn't have a lot of national experience and hasn't shown or proven that he can win over African-American or Latino voters or even build an organization large enough to you know, take across the country and actually win an election.
Dan, if that's the case, I mean, could we be headed for a future where it's Bernie versus Bloomberg over the summer for the nomination? Imagine that. The progressive anti-billionaire against the billionaire for the hearts and minds of Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, that is 100% a potential eventuality.
Wow.
Who would have thought two Jewish candidates from New York vying for the Democratic nomination against a Republican from Queens?
Let's give the last word to Paul, who emailed, the Republican base votes for the party's candidate. Members of the Democratic base vote for their preferred candidates, then abandon the actual nominee. Whoever the Democratic candidate is, they will not be preferred by many, perhaps most, Democrats. If Democratic voters cannot get over having their preferred candidate lose the primary, they will be doomed to another 4 years of Donald Trump.
I agree.
That's the last word to Paul. I want to thank my guests, my experts, for helping guide us through this very divided Democratic Party. Dan Neuhauser, senior political reporter for Vice News. Dan, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Yvette Simpson is CEO of Democracy for America, Progressive Political Action Committee. Yvette, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Maria Cardona is the principal of the Dewey Square Group. She's a former senior advisor to the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign 2008. Thank you so much.
Muchas gracias.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the website at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.